It's the energizing beat of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch. And that means it's Wednesday, 8 p.m., and time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm your host this evening, Eric Heen, and along with Dr. Hank Rubicek, the founder of this program, and Dr. Mary Edgerton, Dr. Warren Holloman, Greg Audell, and our incomparable engineer and media maven, Tatiana Gago, we celebrate the power of story. We do this by placing the spotlight on storytellers who take us on journeys through worlds that stretch the boundaries of the human spirit. And when we return from these journeys, memories of these stories become a part of our lives. Well, there are many different kinds of stories, and one kind is folk tales. Now, folk tales aren't written by Nobel Prize winners. They spring up from the regular people, and they usually get passed around by word of mouth a lot before they even get written down. So hearing folk tales is a great way to experience the real nitty-gritty of human nature. And tonight we have two excellent storytellers to tell them. One teller is originally from India, the other is from Illinois, and we'll see how stories originating from vastly different regions might show us that we're not as different as we might think. Dr. Sneha Dizza was born in Singapore, raised in India, and moved here to Houston at age 23. She's married, and she's a practicing psychologist in the Clear Lake area. First time I saw Sneha perform at a Moss Story Slam a few months ago, I could see she was a natural. She's a clear communicator who expresses her stories with humor and just the right amount of emotion, but always with substance and meaning. So not only do Sneha's stories entertain you, they also make you think. Thanks for being here, Sneha.
Thank you, Eric. Thank you so much. I'm so flattered to hear what you have to say about me, because when I attended the first Story Slam ever, I saw you perform, and I instantly became a huge fan of yours. Mm-hmm. So I'm so ecstatic to be here today.
Oh, great. Yeah, well, I got to inject here that Sneha's here on very short notice. I just kind of sprung this thing on her, and she's a good trooper, and here she is, and I really appreciate that, Sneha.
No problem.
Sally Bates Goodrow is a collections development librarian at the Houston Public Library, where she orders books for kids and teens. She especially enjoys folk tales and participation stories, and she's been telling stories professionally since 1986. And Sally is on the board of the Houston Storytellers Guild. Mm-hmm. Now, I've heard it said that good storytellers make you want to live in their stories, but great storytellers give you no choice. And that's how I feel when I hear one of Sally's stories. I mean, I just stop whatever I'm doing and I just live in her story. Great to have you back, Sally.
Well, thank you, and thanks for saying such nice things.
Well, it comes easy. Sneha, I've heard you tell several of your stories, both at the Moth Story Slams now and here on this program. And it seems like you just kind of came out of nowhere. Is all this new to you? Have you been telling stories for a long time?
It's funny that you should say that, because I have never told stories in using such platforms. I've always been a storyteller in social settings, but it was my husband who persuaded me to speak at the Moth. He tried for so many months, and it was finally attending that one Grand Slam that did it for me.
Great. And Sally, how about you? You always seem to be busy with your storytelling career. Do you have any new projects going on?
Well, part of what I enjoy is learning stories from different places and learning what I need to know about the culture to help me do justice to the story. Right now, I'm really interested in stories from the Middle East, and I've been reading and studying some of those.
Wow. You got stuff from all over the world. That's great. Now, Sneha, when Americans think of literature from India, they probably think of like Rudyard Kipling stuff, you know, Jungle Book, and stories from the colonial period. But the people of India were telling their own stories long before the Europeans barged in there. Do Indian parents still read these older tales to their kids?
I sure hope they do. I know my grandfather did, and it was such a wonderful experience. We also subscribed to so many magazines that retold all those old stories once again. And unfortunately, with Alexa and all of that, I don't know who's reading stories anymore, but I certainly hope that these stories are here for a long time.
Oh, yes. Yeah, so we're going to set the colonists aside tonight and go straight to the people and hear the folk tales. In the bedtime stories that Americans' kids grew up with, they're often lessons taught. Like, if you wander out into the woods alone, you're going to be eaten by a wolf, things like that. Do Indian tales have moral lessons like that, too?
Yes. In fact, in school, we had a class called Moral Science, where the teacher would tell us stories. And at the end, she would ask, so what is the moral of the story? And everyone would say the moral in unison. And it was just so cute. But yes, we all have morals to our stories.
Well, let's hear your first story and see if we can see any morals in it.
All right. So my first story is about six blind men and the elephant. It's called The Blind Men and the Elephant. There was these six old men who lived in a village in India, and each one of them was born blind. Now, the other villagers really loved them and kept them away from harm. But these men could not see the world for themselves, so they only could imagine many of its wonders. The one thing that they were really curious about was the elephant. They had been told that elephants could trample forests, could carry huge burdens, frighten young and old with their loud trumpet calls. But they also knew that the Raja's daughter, and Raja is a king, the Raja's daughter also rode an elephant throughout her father's kingdom. And so they wondered, how did the Raja allow such a dangerous creature around their daughter? So they argued day and night about these elephants. One of them said, the elephant must be a powerful giant because he'd heard elephants trample forests and build roads and things like that. The other one said, no, you must be wrong. An elephant must be very graceful and gentle if a princess is riding on it. The third person said, no, I think you're wrong. I've heard an elephant can pierce a man's heart with its terrible horn. Please, said the fourth man, you're all mistaken. An elephant is nothing more than a large sort of a cow. The fifth blind man said, I'm sure that an elephant is something magical. That would explain why the Raja's daughter can travel safely throughout the kingdom. The sixth blind man scoffed and said, I don't believe elephants exist at all. I think we are the victims of a cruel joke. So finally, all the villagers grew really tired of their arguments, and they said, let's arrange for these men to go see an elephant. And a young boy from their village was selected to guide the blind men on their journey. The smallest man put his hand on the boy's shoulder, the second blind man put his hand on his friend's shoulder, and so on and so forth, and they all walked to the Raja's palace. Once they got there, they were greeted by their friend who worked in the courtyard, and he led them to the elephant. The first blind man reached out and touched the side of the huge animal. And he exclaimed, he said, wow, this elephant seems to be smooth and solid like a wall. It must be very powerful. The second blind man, he put his hand on the elephant's trunk, and he said, I think the elephant's like a giant snake. The third blind man felt the elephant's tusk, and he decided, I was right. This creature is as sharp and deadly as a spear. The fourth blind man, he touched one of the elephant's four legs, and he thought, what we have here is an extremely large cow. The fifth blind man, he felt the elephant's giant ear, and he said, I believe an elephant is like a huge fan, or maybe a magic carpet that can fly over mountains and treetops. The sixth blind man, he gave a tug on the elephant's tail and said, this is nothing more than a piece of rope. Dangerous indeed. So now, after that, the gardener left. He said, I'm going to get you some water. And all these six men, they started arguing amongst themselves. Wall, spear, snake, cow, carpet, rope. They started yelling at each other the whole time. Suddenly they heard this loud, angry voice which said, "Quiet! Stop shouting!" It was the Raja. He had been awakened from his nap, and he was very angry. He said, "How can each of you be so right?" The 6 blind men became quiet. They knew that the Raja was a very wise man, and so they decided to say nothing at all. The Raja cooled down and said, "Listen, the elephant is a very large animal. Each one of you touched only one part. Perhaps if you put the parts together, you will see the truth. Now let me finish my nap." So when the friend returned to the garden with the water, the 6 men quietly sat there, thinking and contemplating about the Raja's advice. And the first blind man said, "I think he's right. To learn the truth, we must put all the parts together. Let's discuss this on the journey home." And just like they came to the Raja's palace, they all formed a train once again, and with the guidance of the young boy, returned back with a very important lesson learned.
Wow. I love that tale. Now, the lesson I get from that is, like, you shouldn't come to conclusions until you see the whole picture. You think it's...
Yes, exactly. I mean, there are so many parts that make a whole, and we should definitely look at all of them before jumping to any sort of assumptions.
Yeah. Wish I would have known that when I was younger. Sally, I first met you when we were both guests on this very program with Dr. Hank. And on that show, you talked a bit about how folk tales are more than just entertainment, that they serve other purposes. What makes folk tales and fables so effective at going beyond mere entertainment?
Well, I think that they do many, many things, but in the case of their cultural value, they kind of embody the values and beliefs and the priorities of a culture, and that's one way that those can be passed along in a way that the kids and others will remember.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I always thought that injecting lessons into fairy tales was kind of like when parents put medicine into like a sugary drink, so it goes down easier, so they'll take it.
Yep.
Okay, Sally, let's hear your first story.
All right. This is a story that I learned from a storyteller who tells a lot of stories from the Southwest and also Mexico, Joe Hayes. Mm-hmm. It's called La Hormiguita, which means the little ant. Hmm. So there was once a little ant, and she lived with her mother in the anthill. And one day she asked her mother if she could go out to play, but her mother said, "Oh, I know you think it is spring, sweetheart, but outside the weather may change at any moment, and if the snow falls, you will be trapped out there." But La Hormiguita, she asked and she begged and she asked and she begged until her mother finally said, "Very well, mija, but you must stay very close to the anthill so that I can hear you if you are in trouble." Well, La Hormiguita heard, "You may go," but she didn't really hear the part about staying close by, and so she didn't stay close by. And sure enough, just as her mother said, the sky clouded up a little bit and a few flakes of snow fell. And if you are an ant and a snowflake falls on your leg, then you are pretty much trapped. So La Hormiguita, she shouted to the snowflake. She said, "Snow, snow, get off of my foot so that I may go back to my mother." But the snow would not get off of her foot. So she looked up and a little bit of the sun was peeking out from the clouds. So she said, "Sun, sun, melt the snow. Snow won't get off of my foot and I cannot go back to my mama." But the sun would not melt the snow. So she called out for the cloud, and she said, "Cloud, cloud, cover the sun. Sun won't melt the snow. Snow won't get off of my foot so that I can go home to my mama." But the cloud would not cover the sun. She called out to the wind, and she said, "Wind, wind, blow the cloud. Cloud will not cover the sun. Sun will not melt the snow. Snow will not get off of my little foot so that I can go home to my mama." By now she was getting very angry and a little afraid as well. But the wind would not blow the cloud. So she called out to the wall. She said, "Wall, wall, stop the wind. Wind will not blow the cloud. Cloud will not cover the sun. Sun will not melt the snow. Snow will not get off of my little foot so that I can go home to my mama." But the wall would not. So she called to the little mouse. She said, mouse, mouse, gnaw the wall. Wall will not stop the wind. Wind will not blow the cloud. Cloud will not cover the sun. Sun will not melt the snow. Snow will not get off of my little foot so that I can go back to my mama. But the mouse would not. But on the back of the mouse was a little flea, la pulga. Now, the flea is the cousin to la hormiguita. So she asked the flea, she said, flea, flea, bite the mouse. Mouse will not gnaw the wall. Wall will not stop the wind. Wind will not blow the cloud. Cloud will not cover the sun. Sun will not melt the snow. Snow will not get off of my little foot so that I may go home to my mama. Well, la pulga was her cousin. So the flea began to bite the mouse. The mouse began to gnaw the wall. The wall began to stop the wind. The wind began to blow the cloud. The cloud began to cover the sun. The sun began to melt the snow. The snow got off of her little foot, and she went scampering back in to her mother. And I would like to say that she always did exactly what her mother told her to do after that, but I don't think that would be strictly true.
Well, so there's definitely a lesson there.
Yes, yeah. Always do what your mother tells you. Although, in a lot of folk tales, that's how you have adventures, is by not doing exactly what your mother tells you.
Yeah.
That's how you form memories, right?
Yes, mm-hmm. I've got a few of those memories. Well, this is your host, Eric Heen, with Tichana Gaga, and you're traveling through the fanciful world of folk tales with guest storytellers Sally Bates Goodrow and Dr. Sneha Desai on So What's Your Story, here on Pacifica Radio, Field for Peace on 90.1 FM KPFT Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 for our friends in Huntsville. Tichana, tell us about the world of storytelling in Houston like only you can do.
Well, first of all, Gaga? That's my name now? It's Gago. Lady Gago, Lady Gaga. Yeah, it's okay.
I got you mixed up.
No, it's okay. I'm used to it at this point now. I've had many names on this show, but this one's my favorite.
Okay.
All right, so first, let's talk about our proud sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. The Guild meets the fourth Tuesday of every month at Temple Emmanuel at 1500 Sunset for a story swap. You can come and just enjoy the stories, or you can tell a story of your own. Mm-hmm. It's a friendly, supportive group, and the best place to learn to discover the storyteller in you. When you go to www.houstonstorytellers.org, you will not only find out about the great activities they sponsor, but when you click on the radio program tab, and you'll see the menu of all of our shows dating back from 2008. Over 450 programs originating from our humble little KPFT studio. Remember, So What's Your Story is live every week, and if you don't have a radio, it's no problem and definitely no excuse, because you can listen to us on www.kpft.org, stream live from any place in the world. How cool is that? Mm. Also, you can watch us on Facebook Live, then visit us on our Facebook page, and we'd love it if you like us when you leave. And we are on YouTube. In fact, we're all over the place. And our friends at The Moth are more than fun than the law allows on the second Tuesday of the month. On December 11th, the theme is instinct. My intuition says go, and it's at Warehouse Live. And I'll promise you, you'll have a ball.
A moth ball.
I'm surprised I didn't come up with that myself. I love puns.
Well, thank you, Tichana Gago.
Thank you.
Yeah, The Moth is great. For less than the price of a movie ticket, you got 3 hours of live entertainment there, and it's a great deal. Okay. Sally, the Houston Storytellers Guild has been sponsoring this program for a long time, but most of us don't know the history of the Guild. Can you tell us how it started?
Sure. It was started by Jim Omart and Eileen Hatcher, who went to the National Storytelling Festival, which is held in Jonesboro, Tennessee, in October, which is an amazing event. If you ever get a chance, you should definitely check it out. They came back to Houston, and they were looking for storytellers. They called around to a lot of libraries, because a lot of librarians are storytellers, and they called some other people, and they got a group together that started meeting, and we've been going ever since. And there also is a state storytelling organization which has a festival every spring in Denton, Texas. They bring in a lot of nationally known storytellers as well as feature local tellers and have a summer conference, which our own Dr. Hank has been a part of.
Yeah, never been to that Denton. That's a pretty big deal, I hear.
It is. It's one of the longest running and best managed, I believe, festivals in the country.
Yeah, it's kind of a national one, isn't it? People come from all over.
Well, I think people do now. There used to be a lot more festivals, and a lot of them have gone under. So it's people do come because there aren't that many to go to anymore.
Great. Sneha, who was the storyteller in your home growing up? Were there any...
My grandfather. Mm-hmm. He used to love telling me stories from the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, which are huge mythological books that we have.
Right.
And then he would pay me 1 rupee, which is equivalent to maybe 1 cent now, I guess, for every story that I would read and tell him.
Wow. Oh, that's great. Cool. That is cool.
Yeah.
Sally, did you have any particular storytellers in your family that you recall?
Well, I always felt like my mom was a good natural storyteller. She just, anything she talked about became dramatic and interesting and wonderful. I really enjoyed listening to her, and she was the person who told me my very first story that I ever heard. We were a very literary family. We read a lot, and so... I don't know that we had so many told stories, but we loved stories in lots of different forms.
So that's where you got it. Okay, now, getting back to folk tales, from all over the world are just loaded with animals, and these animals often become metaphors. Sally, do you see this in the stories you come across? I'm sure you've seen a lot of animal stories. Do you see symbolism from animals?
Well, sure. I think people use animals kind of like how people create stereotypes. If they want to focus on one trait or one aspect of a personality, they'll represent it with an animal, like the sly fox or the wolf that is evil and rapacious, or the stubborn donkey. Although I think sometimes these animals do have some of those traits, and they're just magnified, but it's just an easy way to talk about one single trait.
Trait, yeah. You know, I'd always wanted to see the wolf be the good guy once. Never once is the wolf a good guy in a story.
Oh, the true story of the three little pigs. You should read that. It's a picture
true
book.
Story.
It's very funny, where the wolf is the good guy. And so he's just misunderstood.
We've been deceived our whole lives, thinking the wolf was a bad guy. Okay. You know, are animals symbolic in Indian stories as well, Sneha?
Yes, in fact, I don't know if you know about Panchatantra, but those are the oldest published stories from India. And they have been translated into 50 languages, and they have been distributed all over the world. And the main theme of all those stories is animals. Just like Sally said, I think that animals are used to portray a certain trait, and I think kids can identify with animals and really take away the lesson sooner. And it's also kind of a non-judgmental way.
Sure.
To express a lot of different things.
You think of the Jataka tales, too, which are the stories of the Buddha, but they're all animals.
Yes.
You know, I was looking at a list of Indian tales before the show, and they are just chock full of animals. And the one that appeared the most that I saw were the jackal. Is that a pretty significant animal in India, the jackal?
Now, I personally have not seen one, but yes, you're right. There are lots of jackals in all these stories, and the jackal is related to the domesticated dog, to the wolf, to the coyotes. It looks very similar to that.
Yeah.
And the jackal is usually very sly and quick and witty in most of these stories.
Maybe similar to the foxes in the Aesop fables.
Yeah, that could be.
Seems that way. Well, as a side note, in this next story of Sneha's, it features a Brahmin. And Brahmins seem to pop up a lot and Indian stories. Sneha, what exactly is a Brahmin, and why are they in so many Indian stories?
So there is a caste system in India that is still prevalent, but it was created a long time ago to categorize people in different occupations. And the Brahmins belong to the highest caste. They used to traditionally be priests. And because I've married a Brahmin, but he's really not a priest. He's in the IT world.
They're the modern priests.
But they are considered wise and pure and virtuous, and they impart a lot of lessons to the general public. And so in many of these tales, you will see the Brahmin as the main character because they want people to learn from whatever the Brahmins experienced.
Okay. Well, without further ado, let's hear your animal story from India.
All right. So this story is called The Tiger, the Brahmin, and the Jackal. So once upon a time, there was a tiger that was caught in a trap. And he tried so hard to get out of the bars and rolled and bit and was very angry and grieved when he failed. And by chance, a poor Brahmin came by. And the tiger said, "Please, Brahmin, please let me out of this cage." The Brahmin said, "No, I don't think so. You would probably eat me if I did." And the tiger started promising the Brahmin, saying, "No, no, not at all. On the contrary, I will forever be grateful to you and serve you as a slave." So the Brahmin thought about it, and meanwhile the tiger sobbed and sighed and wept, and so the Brahmin's heart softened, and he at last consented to open the door of the cage, and out popped the tiger, and he seized the poor Brahmin and said, "What a fool you are! What is to prevent my eating you now, for after being cooped up so long, I'm just so hungry." The Brahmin started pleading for his life. But the most that he got was a promise that the tiger would abide by the decision of the first three things he chose to question. Mm. So the Brahmin first asked a peepal tree what it thought. And the peepal tree was very cold about it. And he said, "What do you have to complain? Don't I give you shade and shelter and everyone who passes by? And what do they do in return? They tear down my branches to feed their cattle. Do not whimper. Be a man." So the Brahmin was very sad again and started walking further until he saw a buffalo. And he asked the buffalo, what did he think? And the buffalo said, "You are a fool to expect gratitude. Look at me. While I give milk, they feed me on cottonseed and oil cake. But now I'm dry, and they yoke me here and refuse to give me any food." So the Brahmin became even more sad, and he decided to ask the road for its opinion. And the road said, "How foolish you are to expect anything else. Here am I, useful to everybody. Rich and poor, great and small, they all trample on me as they go past, giving me nothing but the ashes of their pipes and the husks of their grain." So the Brahmin turned back, and he was very sad, thinking about his fate. But on the way back, he met a jackal, who called out and said, "Mr. Brahmin, what's wrong? What's the matter? You look as miserable as a fish out of water." So the Brahmin told him everything that had occurred. And the jackal said, "This is very confusing. Can you please tell me all this all over again? Because everything got so mixed up." So the Brahmin did that all over again. And the jackal shook his head in a distracted sort of way and said, "I still don't understand. It's very odd," said he, "because it all seems to go in one ear and out at the other. Maybe I should go to the place where it all happened, and then perhaps I'll be able to give a judgment." So they both returned to the cage, by which the tiger was still waiting and sharpening his teeth and claws. And he growled loudly at the Brahmin and said, "Where have you been? You've been away a long time. Now let us begin our dinner." The Brahmin said, "Our dinner?" And his knees started shaking with fear. And he said, "This is just not right." He said, "Please, please give me 5 minutes so that I can explain matters to the jackal here, who is somewhat slow in his wits." The tiger said, "Okay." He consented. And the Brahmin began the whole story all over again, this time not missing a single detail and spinning as long a yarn as possible. "Oh, my poor brain! Oh, my poor brain!" said the jackal. "Let me see, how did it all begin? You were in the cage, and then the tiger came walking by, and the tiger said, 'No, no, what a fool you are. I was in the cage.' 'Of course,' said the jackal, pretending to tremble with fright. 'Yes, I was in the cage.' 'No, I wasn't. Oh my gosh, dear, dear, where are my wits? Let me see, the tiger was in the Brahmin. And the cage came walking by. No, 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 that's not it either. Please, please begin your dinner, because I will never understand.'" The tiger was frustrated by this point, and he said, "Yes, you will. I'll make you understand. Look here, I'm the tiger." "Yes, yes," said the jackal. "And that is the Brahmin." "Yes, my lord." "And that is the cage." "Yes, my lord. And I was in the cage. Do you understand?" "Yes, no, please." The jackal was very confused. "Well," cried the tiger. He was very impatient. So the jackal said, "Please, my lord, how did you get in? Can you show me?" And the tiger said, "Of course, in the usual way." And the jackal said, "Please, don't be angry. Please, my head is spinning." So the tiger said, "All right. Here." He jumped into the cage and cried, "This way. Now do you understand how it was?" The jackal was very happy. He said, "Perfectly." And he shut the door. And he said, "And if you will permit me to say so, I think matters will remain as they were."
Yeah. That jackal's pretty good at playing dumb, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He's a good actor.
Can be a good tactic. Now, I've noticed that it's almost universal in folk tales that animals will be anthropomorphic. They'll have human traits. They'll talk and wear human clothes and so forth, walk on their hind legs. It seems like that's universal everywhere. And in that story, even inanimate objects had human traits. The tree and the road and everything, they were talking. Is that pretty universal, Sally, that...
I don't think I've ever... I have learned some stories where the tree talks. I've never heard one where the road talks. But I've heard a story very similar to that that ends very differently. Huh. It's where a guy comes across a snake that's very, very cold, and the snake begs him to put him in his pocket to warm him up.
Oh.
And so he says, "But you'll bite me if I do that." And Snake claims that he won't bite him, and persuades the guy to put him in his pocket, which he does. And the snake warms up and warms up, and they continue to discuss. And finally, the snake does bite him.
Uh-huh.
And the guy says, "Well, you promised me you weren't going to bite me." And he said, "But you knew I was a snake when you put me in your pocket." So it's kind of the same story, but a different
ending.
Yeah,
I see that.
Because I guess that person had no one come to his aid.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there are versions of the story you told that I've heard from other countries as well.
Okay. Now, Sneha, I got to ask you a question. I'm kind of putting you on the spot here because the stories you've done at the Moth and so forth are personal narratives.
Correct.
That's all I've ever done. I've never done fiction. And here, we drag you in here to do folk tales, and you're doing great. Is there a difference in a feel of telling a personal narrative about your own experiences and coming in here and talking about jackals? Talking jackals?
Well, Yes, because you have to put yourself, you have to empathize, and you have to put yourself in the writer's shoes and the character's shoes. Now, as a psychologist, I will say that it comes a little easier to me than it would to someone else. Mm-hmm. But it's still, in my opinion, for me, it is a little harder work than telling my own personal story.
Mm-hmm. You know, I would say that, too. It's because you've lived the personal narrative, so you've actually experienced that.
Mm-hmm.
But the fiction story came from somewhere else. So, yeah, I could see how it'd be a whole different ball game there.
Yes, and the interpretation sometimes could be very different. The reader interpret something very differently than the writer.
Exactly. Sally, did you have another animal story?
Sure. This one is a story about Anansi the spider, which is a story from West Africa. Mm. And there are a lot of stories about Anansi, and a lot of them have a lesson as well, but... they also are what's called a pourquoi story. They say why something is the way it is. So mm-hmm. this is one of those.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one day Anansi was sleeping in front of his house, which is something he did a lot of because he did not like to work. And one day one of his friends from a village to the east came running up and said, "Anansi, Anansi, you must wake up and come. We are going to have a feast, and we know how you love to eat." Anansi did love to eat. He had a huge, huge belly back in those days. Well, he said, "I would love to come." But just then, another friend of his from a village to the west came running up and said, "Anansi, we are going to have a dance in a little while, and we would love to have you come and dance. We know how much you love to dance." Well, Anansi, he did love to dance, and he looked one way and he looked the other. He thought, "How am I going to choose between these? Maybe I don't have to." He said, "Do you know what time the feast will begin?" And his friend said, "Well, it will begin when all the food is ready." "Do you know what time the dancing will start?" "Well, it will begin when all the musicians have arrived and are ready to play." "Well," he said, "I would like to come to both of these. How can I do this?" And then he had a thought. He took a long, long piece of rope and he cut it in half. And he tied the ends of both pieces of rope around his waist. And he gave the other end, one to his friend from the village to the east, one to his friend from the village to the west. And he said, "When the food is cooked, pull on the rope and I will come and eat. And when the musicians are ready to play and the dance will begin, pull on the rope and I will come and dance. And that way I can do both things." So his friends went in their various directions, and Anansi went back to sleep. Well, the next thing he knew, he felt a tug on the rope. It was coming from the direction of the food. And so he leaped up and he started walking towards the food. But just at that very moment, he was pulled back because someone was tugging from the other direction. It was time to dance. Oh, eating, dancing, eating, dancing. He was pulled one way. He was pulled the other way. And the ropes got tighter and tighter and tighter around his waist as he was not moving in either direction. Because he was caught between the two of them, the ropes got so tight that finally he fainted. Well, his friends soon enough realized that something was wrong, and they came running. They found him unconscious on the ground with the rope so tight around his waist. Well, they undid the ropes, and they splashed him with water, and they slapped him on the face and woke him up, and he was all right. He was all right, except for that big belly that he used to have was completely pushed down to his abdomen, and now spiders all over the world have a huge abdomen and a tiny, narrow waist. And it's all because Anansi could not choose between eating and dancing.
Ooh.
Well,
so that's
I had no
one.
Idea.
Ah, very educational. His name was Anansi?
Anansi.
Well, you enunciated that very well.
Oh, thank you.
It's a Dr. Hank joke, I'm sorry. Well, there's no getting around what is probably the most common theme of all in folk tales, love and courtship. Sneha, have you ever noticed any general differences in love stories, like American stories and Indian stories?
Well, I think love is so universal. There are so many similarities between these love tales where there are obviously two people in love and then they have obstacles come their way. And then sometimes there's a villain and sometimes love triumphs. Sometimes it's through a union, mm-hmm. sometimes through death. And the differences that I have seen is that the types of obstacles that these lovers face are very different.
Oh.
But overall, I think it talks about how love is universal mm-hmm. and really very powerful.
Okay. Well, can we hear an Indian love tale?
Sure. So the story I'm about to tell you is about Heer Ranja. Heer is the girl and Ranja was the boy. And it is set in the 1400s in the state of Punjab. Now at that time, the villages that they both came from were a part of India, but now in current times, it is a part of Pakistan. So this could be a Pakistani love tale. So once upon a time, there was this young man called Dido, and his last name was Ranja. He lived on a farm with his very wealthy father and four brothers in the village of Takht Hazara. Now, because he was the youngest and his father's favorite, he was never forced to toil hard on the farm. And instead, what he did all day was play his flute and bask in the sun all day long. This angered his brothers very much. And when his father passed away, his brothers did not give him a good piece of land as inheritance, and his brothers' wives would not give him food to eat. So Dido became very angry and upset, and he left the village. While wandering around, he reached the banks of the river Chenab, and he asked to ride in a ferry that was waiting there. But since it was very dark, the ferryman said, "Why don't you wait here and we will go off the next morning?" Ranja wanted to sleep on a bed, and the ferryman would not allow him to sleep on that bed. So Ranja played his flute, and he played it so beautifully that the ferryman was mesmerized, and he allowed him to sleep on the ferry. Ranja picked a very luxurious bed, which turned out to be Heer's bed. Hmm. Now, who is Heer? Heer was the daughter of the head of the Sial clan, a royal family. And when Heer saw that Ranja was sleeping on her bed, she was very angry. But when Ranja opened his eyes and played the flute, Heer was mesmerized as well. And she fell in love with Ranja. Ranja also believed it was love at first sight. They spent the whole day together on the ferry, fell in love, and decided to get married. So the next day when they got to Heer's village, Heer took Ranja to her father and said, "Father, I've brought someone to herd the buffaloes." Father, whose name was Chuchak, he hesitated. He didn't know who this stranger was. But then he loved his daughter so much, he agreed to hire this man. And every day from then on, Heer brought Ranja milk and bread and sweets and rice and spent the whole day with him in the forest. She started neglecting her girlfriends, she stopped doing all her chores, and soon gossip started to spread throughout the village. Now when Heer's uncle, Kaidu, heard about this gossip, he decided he wanted to catch them one day red-handed. But he couldn't. He tried very hard. So one day, he found Ranja alone in the forest, pretended to be a beggar, and went up to Ranja and asked for food. Ranja remembered the times when he was begging around after he left his own village, and he gave him half of a pastry that Heer had made for him. So what the uncle did was he took this pastry as proof to the village, saying, "Look, this is what Heer has been doing. She has a relationship with Ranja." So now, to avoid further scandal, Heer's parents decided that they should marry Heer off. Now, Chuchak, the father, was okay with Heer marrying Ranjha, but the villagers said that because Ranjha didn't come from a royal family, that was not acceptable. So the family decided to marry Heer off to another royal family. Mm-hmm. She left. She got married and she left. In the meantime, Ranjha was heartbroken and he wandered around. He became a beggar because he left his job as a buffalo herder. And he decided to make his way to the village where Heer now lived with her husband. He begged at every single door until he found her home. When the Heer's sister-in-law opened the door and she realized who Ranjha was, she agreed to help them. She agreed to help them run away. They pretended that Heer had been bitten by a snake and that Ranjha would be the one to save her life. They put them both in a room, and it was from that room that they both managed to escape and went back to Heer's village. So now Kaidu, the husband, he was very angry and felt extremely humiliated. Meanwhile, Heer's family decided that they needed to give Heer and Ranjha a proper wedding. So what Ranjha did was he went back to his village, Takhtazara, to prepare for the wedding procession. And Heer was getting ready to be a bride again. But Kaidu sent over sweets to Heer to eat, and those sweets were poisonous. Heer ate one of those sweets and dropped dead. She died. Mm-hmm. When Ranjha found out what had happened, he ran over. He had some hope that he would be able to save her, but it was too late. So he decided to eat the sweets himself, and he died as well. Mm-hmm. And it's said now that Heer and Ranjha are currently buried in the same tomb, and this is a very, very popular love story in South Asia.
Wow. Yeah, I looked it up before the show. They've made 14 movies out of that. I mean, not sequels, 14 movies out of that same.
Yes, and there are many different versions of this story as well. Some of them have a happy ending.
Ah, not that one.
Mm-mm.
Wow. There's parallels to Romeo and Juliet there.
Yes, very much so.
The family conflicts, the two lovers dying in the end.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that was pretty tragic.
Very intense.
Sally, I suppose there's no shortage of love stories in your repertoire.
No. Well, yeah. I just don't think there are shortages anywhere. this story that I wanted to share is a British story, and it has actually two different kinds of love in it, which is one reason that I like it. There once was a rich man, and he had three daughters. And one day he thought he'd like to see how much they loved him. So he called them in, and he asked the first one, and he said, "How much do you love me?" And she said, "Oh, Daddy, I love you better than all of my pretty dresses." And he said, "That's good." So he asked the second one, and she said, "Daddy, I love you better than all the jewels I have in my jewelry box." And he said, "That's good." And he asked the third one, and she thought for a long time, and then she said, "Daddy, I love you as meat loves salt." "What? What?" he said, "as meat loves salt? Why, you don't love me at all. And in my house, you will stay no more." And he drove her out there and then and shut the door in her face. Well, she picked herself up and she started walking. And she walked and walked. And she walked until she came to a fen, a marsh. And she gathered up a lot of rushes and she stripped them into long strips and wove them together and made herself a kind of a cloak with a hood to cover up her beautiful long hair and her fine clothes. And then she walked and she walked until she came to another fine house, as fine as the one she had left behind. But this time she knocked on the kitchen door and she asked for work. Well, they offered her a job in the kitchen to wash the pans and scrub the pots. And so she stayed there and lived in the kitchen. and slept in front of the fireplace, and because of the strange clothes that she wore, they called her Cap of Rushes. Well, after a while, she had met everyone in the house one way or the other. There was the master and his wife, and they had a son who was a little bit older than she was, who was always kind and had a good word for everyone. And one day, they were invited to a dance a little ways off. And the servants were also invited to go on and look at the fancy people dancing. But Cap of Rushes said she was too tired to go. But as soon as they had gone, she offed with her Cap of Rushes and she went away to the dance. And there was no one there as lovely as she was. Well, the young master took one look at her and fell in love with her. He would not dance with anyone else nor speak with anyone else. He spent the whole evening by her side, and when she would not give him her name, he took his ring off and gave it to her. But before the dance was over, she slipped away, and when the others returned, she was pretending to be asleep by the fire with her Cap of Rushes on. And they said, "Oh, Cap of Rushes, you should have been there last night. The young master was there, and he's fallen for a lady, and no one knows who she is." Well, the next day, the young man started looking for that girl. He went from house to house, asking who she was, but nobody knew who she was, nor where she had come from. And by, he got worse and worse for love of her until he could not get out of his bed. Well, one day, Cap of Rushes came into the kitchen, and she came upon the cook, and the cook was stirring something on the stove. And Cap of Rushes said, "What are you doing?" And the cook said, "I'm making some gruel for the young master. Why, he's so weak, I'm afraid he's going to die for love of that girl." And Cap of Rushes said, "Well, let me make the gruel." At first the cook said no, but then she let Cap of Rushes finish making it. And when Cap of Rushes had finished it, she put the ring he had given her in the bowl and covered it up with the gruel. Well, the footman took it upstairs, and the young man sat up as best he could in bed and started to eat, and his spoon hit that ring, and he drew it out. And he immediately sat up all the way, and he said, "Fetch me the cook." And the cook came up and stood in front of him, and he said, "Did you make this gruel?" And she said, "Yes," for she was frightened. And he said, "Don't worry. Tell me who it was. You shan't be harmed." And so she said, "'Twas Cap of Rushes made the gruel," and up she came. And he looked at her and looked at her. And he said, "Did you make this gruel?" And she said, "Yes, I did." And he said, "Then where did you get this ring?" And he said, "From the one who gave it to me." And he said, "Then who are you?" She offed with her Cap of Rushes and showed him who she was, for there she stood in her fine clothes. Well, they were to be married in a little time, and all the people were invited from miles around, including Cap of Rushes' father. But the morning of the wedding, she went down to the kitchen, and she says to the cook, "I want you to make every dish without any salt at all." And the cook looked at her and said, "That will taste rare nasty." She said, "Nevertheless, that's what you must do." And so they were married. And after they were married, they all sat down to eat. And Cap of Rushes' father, he tried first one dish and then another, and then he cut the meat and chewed it, and he began to cry. And the young master said, "What's the matter?" He said, "Oh," he said, "I once had a daughter, and I asked her how much she loved me. She said, 'As meat loves salt,' and I drove her away, for I thought she did not love me. But now I see she loved me best of all, and she could be dead for all I know." But Cap of Rushes stood up, and she said, "No, father, here she is." And she went to him, and she put her arms around him. And so they lived, as should we all, happily ever after.
Hmm. That's great.
It's a beautiful story.
Oh, thanks.
I heard a little bit of Romeo and Juliet in Sneha's last story. There's a little King Lear in that one.
It is. In fact, that's a very old, old story.
It maybe predated Shakespeare. Maybe he
who knows?
Borrowed a little bit.
Yep.
Well, we've had a lot of stories from a lot of different countries here tonight, and they have a lot of shared values, I've noticed. And so I think that shows that when it comes down to being human, We're all the same species with the same hopes and fears, the same flaws and virtues. And I think we've proved that tonight with these tales told by these two fine storytellers. I suspect that 1,000 years from now, people will be sharing stories in that same spirit. So, do you have any shout-outs? Want to say hi to anybody? Family members? Thanksgiving guests?
We can all say
nosy neighbors.
Happy Thanksgiving to all the storytelling people. I'm sure there will be many, many stories told around the Thanksgiving table. Mm-hmm. It's a good time to get the old people to share some of their stories, to share some of your own. How about you, Sneha?
Well, tomorrow is Thanksgiving, but tomorrow is also my beloved dog's Gotcha Day. I got him 4 years ago on November 22nd, and he has changed my life, which I did talk about the last time I was here, about how he changed my life. So definitely a shout out to him. Mm-hmm. Eric, thank you so much for inviting me. This was wonderful. I had a blast.
Thanks for being here.
And a shout out to my husband, because if it were not for his encouragement, I would not be in this storytelling business, as you would call it.
Yes, thank you.
As of today.
Yeah. And so it is with my wife. I wouldn't be sitting here right now if it weren't for her. A little touchy-feely ending there. Well, and speaking of Thanksgiving, I am thankful to both of you for being here tonight.
Oh, thanks for having
Thank
us.
Thank you.
Well, we wish all of you a safe and blessed Thanksgiving, and may your day be filled with stories. Stay right here where you are for the very new, very cool Flash Gordon, and make KPFT 90.1 an everyday part of your life. And join us every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Eric Heen, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, please always remember that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace. Kitchen door. You better not let him in. Little old lady got mutilated late last night. Werewolves of London again. Ah, werewolves of London.
Many companies will match gifts made to nonprofit organizations. A matching gift from your company will help KPFT preserve independent music, arts, news, and views for generations to enjoy. Just make a gift to KPFT This Hour at kpft.org. Then contact your human resources office for eligibility requirements and to obtain a matching gift form. Many companies match the gifts of retirees, spouses, and surviving spouses too. Just fill out the employee portion of the form completely and send the form to KPFT, Attention Matching Gifts, 419 Lovett Boulevard, Houston, Texas, 77006. Your gift to KPFT could double if your company has a matching gift program. Your help makes a difference. This is 90.1 KPFT, Houston.
Flash Gordon's heart, so